testing. 1, 2, 3. There we go. All right, there we go. I will do my best to not accidentally mute this. Okay, our passage this morning is from Luke 23, verses 13 through 32. We find Jesus getting toward the end of his trial and about to enter upon crucifixion. He has just come back from when Pilate sent him to Herod, and Herod sent him back to Pilate. Jesus is getting bounced around. You get the idea that everyone is kind of intrigued with him, interested in him as a person, but no one really wants to have to deal with him. As I studied this passage, I was actually struck by how many details Luke does not include. The Gospel of Luke is known for being factually thorough, but there's still much that could have been written that is not. And it got me thinking about how we live in this time that is very accurately called the information age. You know, there's almost nothing that you can't, there's no fact about many things that you can't just find out right away by Googling it. I was really struck by the unusual nature of living in a time like this when me and Alexi were expecting a baby, and then we're expecting another baby, and of course the first question someone asks is, what, are you having a boy or a girl? And we, being very unusual people, decided to not find out. But it was such a, it was an interesting, I would almost call it like a cultural experiment, because it takes so much effort to not know the sex of the child that you're about to have. Like, you have to turn your head, you can't look in the envelope, you have to tell, you have to plan it all ahead of time. And then most people were like, oh, that's really cool that you're doing that. But some people were just, you know, it's like I ruined their day because they didn't know whether to buy a pink or a blue onesie. And it's you know, it's this one little area that we just decided to, like, choose to not know something. But what that shows you about our society, our mindset, our culture, is that we are used to knowing everything all the time, ahead of time. We have all been looking at our phones for the forecast, seeing, oh, you know, we see what's coming. It's very useful a lot of times, but I think a lot of us can probably relate to at least one instance in your life where the accumulation of knowledge, the seeking of knowledge for its own sake, of information for its own sake, becomes paralyzing, or it takes away from the purpose of the knowledge. And so, what we see in the Gospels, and we see in the Gospel of Luke, is we see Luke telling us, compiling for us, a story not about information, not about facts, not about interesting cultural things that were going on at the time. It's about Jesus. He's writing to us about the Messiah. And he writes in Luke chapter 1, we actually see Luke telling Theophilus that he wanted to put together an orderly account so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. So he's reaffirming, the whole point of this book is to reaffirm this is who Jesus is. And so just thinking about our pursuit of information, how the information itself kind of becomes an idol, it kind of becomes distracting, it kind of becomes the whole point, and it gets in the way of the real point. I decided in my studying, just to give myself like a fun limitation, I decided not to do any cross-referencing, to pretend as though I am reading Luke's gospel, and I am only a recipient of that gospel. I'm not looking for additional other information about the stories that we see in this passage. I preached last year on Jesus having a confrontation with a demon-possessed man, and I did cross-referencing with all three other gospels, but I just thought it would be fun to kind of focus on the passage for its own sake, and kind of engage in what Luke alone is trying to tell us about Jesus. And part of this comes too, for me as a musician, I've noticed there's a saying not just in music, but in art overall, that I heard a long time ago, and I hear it repeated in different ways and different forms, but that saying, that anecdote is this: limitation is good for art. You know, some of the best pieces of art have been done in circumstances that, whether it be a painting, whether it be a musical recording, or a play. I mean, a lot of us have heard the story of Handel's Messiah being written in a very short time when he was going through some, you know, it wasn't as if he just was at ease, you know, with a bunch of paper and a bunch of musicians. You get the idea that it was a traumatic time for him as he was writing this, and it's one of the greatest pieces of art in music in the world. And so as we take that approach in music, realizing that sometimes that obstacle, that barrier that you have in front of you, is the thing that makes you creative, makes you figure out a different way to do it, which ends up being the thing that makes a great piece of art. So when we study the Bible, isn't it a cool idea to think of it as, you know, as a pursuit where we don't need, I mean, we have access to these commentaries, we have access to cross-references and all this stuff, but even in the passage itself, there's so much richness, there's so much there that maybe if we clear it all aside for a second and just look at it, we can find something that we might not have noticed before. So that was my approach in studying today. This passage features three main characters whose lives are intersecting with Jesus. We have Pilate, Barabbas, and Simon of Cyrene. So first we look at Pilate, who tries to release Jesus three more times. Luke actually doesn't tell us the reason for Pilate trying so hard to free Jesus. Again, I could have researched that, but I chose not to. Luke doesn't tell us. He allows us to wonder at the noticeably unusual nature of a powerful Roman ruler trying to free someone like Jesus, who to him would have, under normal circumstances, been just another Jewish man accused by some people of some things. But Luke shows that this is not just another day in the life for Pilate. Luke points to the specialness of Jesus through this interaction. He focuses on how someone powerful wanted to protect him, almost supernaturally, apart from anything Jesus himself had said to or done for Pilate. As Steve pointed out last week, we see the continued injustice of Jesus' whole trial. Each time Pilate tries to reason with the crowd can say absolutely nothing rational in accusation of Jesus. As you read through this passage, you just get this idea that of what we think of when we think of a mob, a riot, just truly an insane group of people who are not in their right mind. Pilate offers to punish and release Jesus, thinking that might satisfy the crowd, but he's wrong. This crowd doesn't just want Jesus to suffer, they want him dead. And all the while, the crowd is unable to give one reason why. Pilate keeps asking, why can't you tell me why you want this man to be crucified? And they won't say. And that's how all opposition to Jesus is. It can't be rational. A rational response to everything about who Jesus is to embrace him and follow him. His love and mercy appeal to the needy human soul like nothing else. But to the heart against God, the heart who has set itself up as its own God, that heart sees Jesus as the ultimate threat to its selfishness and pride. And then there is only an insatiable and irrational hate for the Son of God. We see it in the crowd in this passage, but we see it today too. We see it everywhere, an inarticulate but vehement hatred of Jesus. Many are happy to hear about all kinds of religions and beliefs, and are even happy to discuss Christianity, as long as it is in a context of one way among many possible truths. But present Jesus on his own terms, as who he claimed to be, and the unbelieving crowd shuts him down and sends him away. Pilate tries three times to reason with the crowd. After failing, he hands Jesus over. Now he could have still freed Jesus even after all this. Pilate had the power to do whatever he wanted in this case. But his civic duty was to keep the peace. He knew a riot would start if he freed Jesus, even more than there already was going on. So he gave in to the crowd. He chose job stability over the Son of God. He condemned Jesus to death. Moving on to Barabbas, Luke tells us that Barabbas was a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. The detail about insurrection shows us that Barabbas was a reckless person who was either a leader or a part of a violent uprising, someone who doesn't think about consequences, someone who leads with their emotions. Uprisings were fairly common in Jesus' day, and they were a danger to the stability that the Roman government had been so successful at establishing by quickly stopping uprisings as soon as they started. We don't know who he murdered or how many people he murdered, but we know that the other reason Barabbas had been imprisoned was for murder. The crowd was so irrationally obsessed with having Jesus crucified that they begged Pilate to release an unpredictable murderer into their streets instead. To the extent that any culture embraces God, that culture becomes a culture that loves and values life as well, seeing as each human bears the image of God. There have been glimmers of this in different times and different places throughout history when a country would collectively turn to God and experience the many blessings and joys of living in a place where every life is honored. Conversely, any time a people rejects God and turns to idolatry, ironically, despite claiming to seek our own good, the culture becomes one of death and murder at the hands of one who seeks to steal, kill, and destroy. The culture we find ourselves in right now is one with so much murder. As many of you know, me and Alexi have a podcast called Coffee with Crime, and I talk about coffee, which is nice for me because I get to talk about the lighthearted thing, and she talks about some sort of criminal case, usually ending in murder. And it's interesting, you know, we've learned a lot about coffee and about crime, I guess, doing the podcast, but one of the things that really strikes me every time we do another episode is that we could do an episode every day and never run out of murders. Think about that. Just last week, I learned from Wayne that a school shooting occurred recently in a small town in Iowa. There's murder of the unborn and abortion, and an overall culture of death from drug abuse, death from alcoholism, death from suicide, death from many different reasons. And all this has become so common that the most news outlets don't even consider any of these stories newsworthy. In a sense, when Jesus gets shoved away, we invite a murderer into our streets. If we pause for a moment and ask the question, where do we go from here? Can God possibly restore this country to being a place where life is honored again? By now, we've seen enough to know that no one in politics can fix this. Jesus is the only one who can heal. He asks us to carry his simple, life-giving message into the world. Recently, I've been listening to a song by a guy named Chris Rice. I don't know if anyone knows him, but not really well known, but he's been writing Christian music for a while. And there's a song called "Go Light Your World." You can look it up. You can find it anywhere. And the chorus goes like this: "Carry your candle, run to the darkness, seek out the helpless, deceived, and torn. Carry your candle, candle for all to see it. Take your candle and go light your world. Notice how it says, run to the darkness. It kind of surprised me to hear a phrase like that in a Christian song. I guess, personally, I'm more used to being told to run from the darkness. And that is true when it comes to sin and temptation. We are to run from darkness. But if the one who is in us is greater than he who is in the world, there will be moments when God calls us to run toward the darkness, despite fears, despite dangers, trusting God for protection, because he wants us to use us to shine the candle light of the life-giving knowledge of Jesus to a death culture that desperately needs to hear. It's never been more true that America needs missionaries to do missions in America. By virtue of being believers and living here, you and I, we are those missionaries. So what happened to Barabbas? Well, we never hear about him again. God knows, but Luke's gospel doesn't tell us anything further about him. We don't find him involved with Jesus in any way, which seems unusual, at least to me, considering his freedom was directly tied to Jesus' condemnation. Moving on to Simon of Cyrene. At this point, Jesus is not only exhausted from sleep deprivation, being tried illegally overnight, but has also been beaten, and he is physically unable to carry the cross he was about to be crucified on, which was one of the Romans' many ways of humiliating condemned criminals. There's no way any of the soldiers would have stooped to the level of performing this humiliating task, so they grab a random person, presumably someone who looked strong enough, and forced him to carry it. It happened to be a man named Simon from a place called Cyrene. A contemporary reader of this gospel would have known where Cyrene was in modern-day Libya, North Africa, a journey of over 2 weeks from Jerusalem. Now, Simon did not want to carry the cross for Jesus. He did not volunteer to do this. Luke says the soldiers seized him and put the cross on him and made him carry it, and he carried the cross behind Jesus. So we're really looking at someone who's fearing for his life, just ends up being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and as a way of not, you know, having a soldier kill him, he does this very humiliating thing that they ask him to do. We have no idea what happened to Simon after this. Luke makes no mention of him showing any interest in Jesus after this incident. I think Simon is mentioned by name to show how forsaken Jesus was. Keep in mind, there was another Simon, Simon Peter, who should have been carrying that cross for Jesus, but he was hiding, afraid, denying his Lord. So instead of having any of his disciples help him in his moment of need, a stranger, a traveler, carries Jesus' cross instead. To me, this passage paints a picture of Jesus as forsaken, not only by God, but by all people, powerful and weak, rich and poor, forsaken by all. In all three cases, in all three men, very different men, in very different situations, Jesus confronts them simply by his existence. Jesus wasn't preaching to these men, knocking at their door. The circumstances of Jesus' life simply coincided with each of them in an unavoidable way. And surely none of them were the same afterward. Whether they believed in him or not, we don't know. Surely they never forgot about Jesus. Jesus' existence confronts us as well. Once we learn about him, there's no going back. Believing in him is a yes or no question. In these three men, and you know, someone else studying this passage might come away with something different, but just I saw passivity. Any one of them had the chance to be known for coming to the defense of the Son of God, but they each go down in history as men who get as far from Jesus as they can, as soon as they can? Will you defend Jesus' kingship to the hateful crowd? Or like Pilate, will you get tired, throw up your hands, and consider him a lost cause? Will you follow Jesus when his death sets you free? Or will you, like Barabbas, disappear, never to be heard from again? Will you carry a cross if Jesus asks you? Or will you shy away like Simon Peter so that a stranger stumbles into the task? Jesus calls to each one of us to believe in him and to live in obedience to him. Will you shrink in fear or will you move forward in belief? Jesus says something very ominous to the women who were mourning for him as he walked toward Golgotha. In Luke 23, verse 28, he says to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry?" In this statement, Jesus is quoting from Hosea, God's warning of judgment for rejecting him and turning to idols. This theme is repeated in Revelation. And the tree was green, so to speak. The conditions were perfect. In the fullness of time, God had sent his Son. Prophecy spoke specifically of him. All his miracles and his birth confirmed his right to be called Messiah. Yet, the people rejected him and condemned him to death. Jesus is saying, if this kind of travesty happens when the conditions are right, at a time when God is trying to send salvation, then how terrifying to think of what will happen when God sends judgment. It's stunning that Jesus, beaten, weak, about to be executed, would speak of the day when he comes back in judgment. Revelation 17 says, "They who are with him are called chosen and faithful. May we be found with him." May the story of history be written with each of us as characters who did not forsake Jesus, but stayed by his side through everything. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for inspiring the gospel writer Luke to give us this this account. I pray that we would take it seriously, that we would learn from it, that we would incorporate this into our lives, that it would not be for me or any of us an exercise in acquiring information to our minds, but that we would be doers of your word, that we would stand by your side, that we would bring life to the murderous and death-filled culture around us. Change this country, change this world through the power of your simple, life-giving gospel message. Amen.